From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, a famous TV personality entered the political arena. No, not Fred Thompson, who did finally throw his hat into the ring. I'm talking about Oprah.
He is someone new. Someone I think the country needs to get to know.
This is my senator, my favorite senator.
I really do believe in Barack Obama. If he was running for mayor, you know, school superintendent, if he was running for president, I believe in him.
Oprah Winfrey appeals to an impressive base of potential voters. Nearly 8.5 million people watch her program every weekday, 2 million buy her magazine. And those are just two components of a media empire that has made her, according to Forbes, the wealthiest woman in the entertainment industry. Until this presidential race, Winfrey has never publicly endorsed a political candidate. But this weekend, she's hosting a $2,300-a-plate fundraiser at her California home for Barack Obama. The celebrity endorsement is certainly nothing new in presidential politics. But as University of Southern California history professor Steve Ross explains, Oprah is no regular celebrity.
Oprah's endorsement is probably the most important celebrity endorsement in the worlds of television and film that could come out. And here's the reason why. If Oprah can get even 1% of the national population to vote who did not vote before, as we've seen from the last two elections, that 1% can make all the difference in the world.
Oprah Winfrey clearly has transcended race, but do you think she has the ability to mobilize African Americans in the way that others do not?
Yeah, I think she does. African Americans, as we know, are overwhelmingly Democrat, but in the last few elections, they've become increasingly jaded, feeling that the Democrats have taken them for granted and have taken advantage of them. But when you suddenly get somebody like Oprah behind a candidate and also a black candidate, I think you have a different situation than you've ever had in the past.
Give me a little history, please. Did Clark Gable ever endorse a candidate or, I don't know, Barbara Stanwyck, W.C. Fields?
Well, the first endorsement I ever saw was around 1912, Mabel Normand, who was a big silent movie star, comedian, who Charlie Chaplin was working with, went around to the local theaters in Los Angeles endorsing the socialist candidate for mayor. And by the 20s and 30s, most active movie stars who were sort of endorsing politicians would be people like Melvin Douglas, Edward G. Robinson. But you also had Louis B. Mayer creating a breeding ground for Republicans at MGM Studios. Famous politicians would come to L.A., and Mayer would find out who the politician's favorite movie star was. And he would make sure that there would be plenty of photographs shot at the studio, and those pictures would be sent throughout the wire services in America and even abroad. And suddenly you would get this huge publicity hit of candidate X with, you know, some major Republican star. And that was, in a sense, the beginning of the really churning out of a kind of formal relationship between Hollywood Washington.
In the 85 years between Mabel Normand and Oprah Winfrey, which would you say were the most prominent celebrity endorsements, and which do you suppose had the greatest effect?
In 1960, a young senator from Massachusetts goes up to a New York apartment of the most popular singer in America, which was not Elvis, which was not Frank Sinatra, but was Harry Belafonte, and asks Belafonte for his endorsement, hoping to, you know, get the black vote. And he tells Kennedy that he'll endorse him, but only if he meets with Martin Luther King. So Kennedy agrees to meet with King, and in turn, Belafonte films a TV commercial that has him and Kennedy walking into a Harlem apartment talking with an ordinary black couple about their concerns. And that has a huge impact on the African-American community. If you look at the right, 1968, you have Charlton Heston switching from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. He was somebody who was fairly well respected, and after all, he was Moses. More than anything else, Heston, you know, ushers in an era of image politics that we can see connected directly to Governor Arnold in California today. And his word carries huge weight amongst many moderate and conservative people in America. And when he announces that he believes Richard Nixon is the man, it creates quite a buzz. And I would say had a significant impact in 68.
Whether it's Charlton Heston or Mabel Normand or Jerry Seinfeld for Kerry or anybody who can call attention to a candidacy, that's very different from mobilizing the vote. Do you believe that Oprah will have unprecedented success in actually mobilizing votes from real-life human beings?
Yes, I do. Like a Charlton Heston, she has an image of gravitas. She is seen as a really serious person. The books she endorses are serious books. The issues she raises on her show are serious issues. And so you have millions of people watching her, listening to her, respecting her. And when Oprah comes out, and particularly for the first time, says, this is somebody you should really pay attention to, I think people are going to really pay attention to Barack. And many of those people who would not have voted in previous elections are now going to go out and vote.
Steve, thank you.
My pleasure.
Professor Steve Ross teaches at the University of Southern California. His next book will be titled Hollywood Left and Right, How Movie Stars Shaped American Politics.
Oprah may have an air of gravitas, but what about the campaign coverage itself? National Journal columnist William Powers argued recently that for a variety of reasons, the soft feature has become the entree of political reporting and the hard policy story, the side dish. Powers has identified three categories of what he calls softness, starting with the, quote, small-town color piece.
For example, there was one recently in Derry, New Hampshire. This was USA Today, Rudy Giuliani at a strip mall. The reporter wrote, as media cameras whirred at a diner, Giuliani played with the baby granddaughter of the owner and waxed appreciative of the state's foliage. And then he moves on to the Hudson Cafe, where he discussed his collection of elephant ties and drew his plan for a border fence on a little piece of paper. Now, there you get a little bit of policy there. He drew his plan for a border fence, so immigration's coming in. It's kind of the diner story, the classic category. You know, sit down with people in the diner where the candidate's campaigning somewhere nearby and talk to them.
And in fact, you noted that on the Washington Post blog, there's actually a regular feature called Candidates in Diners.
Yeah, they have a new category on the Washington Post campaign blog, and the new category is called The Diners. And it's a recurring feature.
Why do they feel they're advancing the story by moving from Diner A to Diner B to Diner C, but not if they go back and further anatomize war policy?
You're not advancing the story, but when you go from Diner A to Diner B, at least you're encountering some new character who has some new feature about them that you can write a few sentences about that are going to feel grabby when you hand it into your editor or producer. That's not going to be revisiting the same old war issues that actually feel like they haven't changed since 2 weeks ago.
But these characters in the diners haven't changed for about 45 years. Another category, the second category you talk about, is the human interest take. We saw an example of that not long ago where there was a big article on managing kids on the campaign trail.
Yes, here was the New York Times, I believe it was on a Sunday, on the front page, a feature story about how many candidates this time around have children under the age of 10, and isn't that fascinating? The story was written with a nice soft touch. I appreciated it. But it was another example of this kind of focus on the human interest side of the candidates now, not the public in the diners, but the candidates themselves and their families filling all this empty news hole. Another example would be, in my opinion, a notable one this summer was the rise of Jerry Thompson, Fred Thompson's wife, as a figure of intense interest to the news media and on the internet long before he was a candidate. I mean, it was remarkable. There were Jerry Thompson stories everywhere. There was a Jerry Thompson story on the front page of the Washington Post in early August called The Rise of Jerry Thompson.
Oh, yeah. That's really remarkable. A tall, willowy, much younger blonde.
Yeah, exactly. There was a big ABC News story about the Romney campaign. It's all in the family, all about the sons of Mitt. Families always figure in campaigns, but I feel my own perception this time around is because of the length of the campaign season, the families are looming much larger and filling a lot more news hole.
Do you see a real difference between this campaign and previous campaigns with regard to what you call the soft stuff? Or is it merely a matter of schedule that things began earlier? Because they begin earlier every single time. I've made that observation practically every election I've covered as a media reporter.
I think it's schedule, but, you know, it's also technology. It is also the explosion of the sheer number of outlets. When, for example, there have been all those debates where the war policy has been gone over a number of times, often the same questions being asked in repeated debates, and all these different news outlets were watching each other have access to that material, there's a feeling that, okay, we've gone through those issues. There's no new way to frame those questions. There's no way to break a new story on those fronts. Let's go to the Edwards family. You know?
So now let's go to the last of the three soft story categories that you point to in your column, the meta stories.
Yes, these are the stories that are about the story, in a way. Stories that are about the contenders using the media to shape their own images, or secondarily, opponents allegedly taking swipes at each other and the media sort of supposedly seeing the warfare behind the scenes. The prime example this summer, I think, being the alleged story of Obama's wife, Michelle Obama, taking a swipe at the Clintons over how they run their family.
Which she really didn't,
which was a kind of a stump speech she had been giving for some time. But one reporter in Chicago said, almost in passing in a piece, that it looked like she was taking a swipe at the Clintons. And it just became this giant meta phenomenon that really amounted to nothing. It was one of these kind of not really a fully fleshed out story, but let's do it. What the heck? It's all about how they're playing in the media.
Then there's the Oprah fundraiser, which we talked about at the top of this hour. That's not just about the money, is it? I mean, some have decried the Oprahfication of the process in past election cycles, but now she's literally part of the process.
She's part of the process, and this one is especially fertile for the soft coverage because Oprah is an entertainment figure. And because she's an entertainment figure, there are just an infinite number of levels to which you can take this story. You can do the story, who are Oprah's people? What is her demographic? You can do the story about Oprah never having gone this far before. Why is she doing it? You can do the story about Oprah and Illinois, since Obama's an Illinois senator. Oprah's influence is so large that I would argue that this is actually a more worthy meta story than any that I can think of. I mean, if you look at what she does for books, you know, if you translate it to candidates, this may actually be a real force here.
Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
William Powers writes the off-message column for National Journal Magazine.
Coming up, how our brains filter out the facts.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Once makers of prescription drugs didn't market direct to consumers, the FDA requirements for listing side effects were prohibitive. In any way, it seemed inappropriate. Then in 1985, a couple of ad men working on a new antihistamine called Celdane figured out a workaround. Their ads peddled the condition but never mentioned the drug. And it worked. People once content to sniffle made appointments with their allergists and sales skyrocketed. Eventually, the FDA loosened restrictions, and now we all swim in a sea of carefully choreographed drug marketing. Some save people's lives. Others just complicate them. Shannon Brownlee has authored a new book called Overtreated: Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer. Among other drugs, she examined the marketing of the sleep drug Lunesta, approved in 2005 and launched with a $60 million ad campaign.
The first ad that appeared was on Desperate Housewives, which was quite appropriate, I think. And it featured a black and white ad where a man and a woman are in bed and the woman gets up, obviously restless in the middle of the night, and she's wandering around the room. And then in through the window comes this incredibly beautiful little Luna moth. And then the voiceover says something like,
"Do you lie awake, exhausted, but still can't sleep? Maybe it's time to ask your doctor if Lunesta's right for you."
It's the only drug that's approved for long-term use. And the market analysts are predicting this explosion in sales in the sleep drug industry. And in fact, that's exactly what happened.
And let's talk about why. It isn't because of the beautiful green moth, however memorable it may have been. It's really because of the third-party strategy.
As one doctor put it, calling what the drug industry does advertising is like calling D-Day a bunch of guys waiting in the surf. So this third-party strategy, what you want to do is you want to get your marketing message into the mouth of an authoritative third party. One of the third parties are patient advocacy groups, and another third party that they like to use are the media.
All right. Well, let's stop and examine those. First of all, the patient advocacy group in the Lunesta case was the National Sleep Foundation. What was interesting to me in your book was that when the organization was launched in the early 90s, it claimed that a little more than a quarter of Americans suffered from a sleep disorder. And by the time Lunesta launched in 2005, it was claiming... Go ahead.
It was claiming that 75% of American adults suffer from some insomnia and that it was ruining their sex lives, which obviously got a few headlines. Well, the National Institutes of Health says at most 25% of Americans are suffering from insomnia, either regularly or occasionally.
And that was the National Sleep Foundation's initial statistic.
That's right. So you sort of wonder whether or not this poll is biased. But then you take the question the next step, which is why would the National Sleep Foundation have this apparently biased poll? And one reason is perfectly understandable. The National Sleep Foundation is genuinely concerned about people getting enough sleep. So they have this sort of natural desire to get people to take sleep seriously. And one way you do that is you exaggerate, A, how many people are suffering from not enough sleep, and B, the dangers of not enough sleep.
Whatever their motivations may have been, if you're accusing them of, in a sense, you know, perpetrating a deceit upon the American people, and we should mention along the line that I don't know what their funding was initially, but during the Lunesta launch, it was already being funded quite a bit by drug manufacturers. It makes you feel queasy.
Yes. Innocently or not, most of them seem to be taking money from the drug industry. One of the marketers for one of the competitor drugs, Sonata, she told me that they very deliberately told organizations like the National Sleep Foundation how to do their polls because they wanted the result that comes with saying lots and lots of people have this disorder called sleeplessness.
We should also note that the National Sleep Foundation gives the press something to cover when it releases its polls. And the press is an important additional third party that you refer to in your book. How do the drug companies make use of the press?
Let me answer the question by kind of going at it from the perspective of the media, who are bombarded with information from a variety of sources. One of those sources is the National Sleep Foundation, which sends out its poll and wants us to write about the results of that poll. Number two, we get information from universities. So one of the places that did some of the research on Lunesta was Duke. And what Duke's PR office did is it offered the press a patient who said Lunesta was the greatest thing that ever happened to her, and it offered up a researcher, a Dr. Andrew Crystal. And it turns out that Dr. Crystal is paid by the company that makes Lunesta. And the press is offered these people as if it's all coming completely independently out of Duke University. So then a bunch of people wrote stories on Lunesta based on that press release.
This is the last thing I want to do, is to quote from a book that you quote called Selling Sickness. With many medical conditions, there is great uncertainty about where to draw the line that separates the healthy from the sick. The wider you draw the boundaries that define a disease, the wider the pool of potential patients and the bigger the market for those making the drug. That all seems sort of straightforward, but how does it affect the way we see ourselves as people?
I think over the last 30 years, the pharmaceutical industry and the patient advocacy groups have in effect made us think we're sick and that we have to be constantly vigilant. It leads to the medicalizing of all of human existence. I mean, every little woe that we have, every worry we have might be depression. You know, every heart palpitation we have might be heart disease. Every headache we have might be cancer. And that's a lousy way to go through your life.
Shannon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Shannon Brownlee is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. Her new book is Overtreated: Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer.
Americans may or may not be as sleep deprived as drug makers claim. But if it were a myth, you could try to quash it with the truth. That's what the Centers for Disease Control Prevention recently did. They sent out a flyer listing various facts and myths about the flu vaccine and labeled them true or false. But a study at the University of Michigan found that the CDC flyer actually did nothing to change people's minds and may have even spread vaccine myths to more people. Shankar Vedantam, a reporter for The Washington Post, explains that right after reading the flyer, people mostly remembered the false statements as false.
But about 30 minutes later, older people started to remember some of the false statements as true. And 3 days later, very large numbers of older people and significant numbers of younger people also started remembering increasing numbers of myths as true. The true statements did not suffer the same kind of deterioration with time. In other words, over time, we tend to remember false things as true, but not true things as false.
Well, I guess there's some hope in that. By what mechanism is this taking place?
The mind relies on a number of rules of thumb, and one of the rules of thumb that it uses is that things that are more easily recalled are true, even if the context in which they originally heard the statement was that the statement is false.
Now, if I understand your piece, when people hear a statement involving a negative, let's say Saddam was not connected to 9/11, and they hear it often enough, somehow the not disappears.
That's right. What happens, unfortunately, is our denial of the myth ends up repeating the myth and makes the myth itself more accessible to people's memory. And furthermore, as the separate study that you note points out, what happens very often is that the knot in the sentence essentially falls off with time in many people's memories.
I want to ask you then about truth squatting, since we're in the midst of political races. Here's the scenario. Politician A makes horrendous charges against politician B, essentially lying about the opposition. A vigilant reporter notices this and does a truth-squatting article in the newspaper that says, no, this campaign ad is simply not true for the following reason. And politician B, of course, immediately starts attacking politician A for misrepresenting his or her record. Who wins?
I think invariably it's going to be politician A. When you have people who are systematically trying to manipulate you, spread propaganda, for instance, and they repeat the same information over and over again, the fact that we are not very good at remembering where we heard a particular piece of information, we tend to believe that we have heard the information from multiple independent sources and therefore must be true, rather than from the same untrustworthy source over and over again.
Now, the studies you're talking about suggest that these effects take place irrespective of the bias of the listener. But there's another study that suggests that if you are, in fact, predisposed to have a certain worldview, that misinformation sticks still more. Can you describe it?
There's a new study that's just been completed by Jason Reifler at Georgia State University, where he actually looks at questions such as why it is that large numbers of people continue to believe that weapons of mass destruction were present in Iraq before the invasion, or even found in Iraq after the invasion. And what Jason and his colleagues did was try and give people the correct information. And what he found, ironically, is that partisans who wanted to believe that weapons of mass destruction had been found in Iraq, when told about the correct information, ended up believing ever more fervently that they were right and that the correct information was wrong.
And this would explain, for example, why throughout the Arab and Muslim worlds, more than half of the population seems to believe that the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon were the work of the U.S. government or Israel.
I think that's right. What's especially disturbing is that the number of people who believe that is actually growing over time. In the study I mentioned, 59% of Turks and Egyptians, 65% of Indonesians, 53% of Jordanians, even 56% of British Muslims do not believe that Arabs were behind the 9/11 attacks. And so presenting them with the correct information, which, by the way, is our government's strategy of combating myths and disinformation, does not seem to be a very effective approach.
So the truth will out, except when it doesn't.
I guess you can say that. One thing that I should mention, Bob, is that when you're trying to deny a falsehood, perhaps the most effective way of doing that is by not mentioning the original falsehood at all. In other words, if someone said that Bob Garfield is for child prostitution, the right response is not Bob Garfield is not for child prostitution, but rather to say Bob Garfield is an upstanding journalist who believes in the finest tenets of journalism and runs a very popular show that's heard widely by many millions of people around the world.
Ah, so in other words, to replace one lie with another. Shankar, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Bob.
Shankar Vaidantam is a reporter and columnist at The Washington Post.
This past Tuesday, two near simultaneous bombs ripped through Pakistan's capital, Islamabad, killing at least 25. This incident and the general unrest in Pakistan suggests that President Pervez Musharraf's call for, quote, enlightened moderation is further unifying Pakistan's radical Islamic movements against him. A new film called In the Name of God directly confronts this clash between radical Islamists and the so-called enlightened moderates. But the fictional drama isn't easy to see. Islamabad has no movie theater after an angry Sunni mob burnt down the last one 4 years ago. But Shahan Mufti, a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, drove almost 5 hours to see the film, and he says it signifies a new dawn in Pakistani cinema.
So this is quite a phenomenon, quite an event. These sort of crowds have not been seen at movie theaters in a while. And not just the numbers, it's the kind of crowd which is predominantly from the middle and upper middle classes and upper classes in Pakistan, a section of the population that is not known to frequent movie theaters. Like you said, there's not a huge culture of cinema in Pakistan anymore.
A major theme of the film is whether music is un-Islamic and therefore should be forbidden. And you wrote that the story is loosely based on the former rock star Junaid Jamshid.
It's a story of two brothers, both of who are musicians. One ends up in Chicago as a music student. The other ends up as a Taliban fighter in Afghanistan. The story of the brother who ends up as a Taliban is loosely the story of Junaid Jamshid, who was the lead singer for a band called Vital Signs. This is back in the 80s, just as the Islamic military government of General Zia-ul-Haq had fallen. And this was a time when particularly the youth in the country was euphoric, it was vibrant, and Vital Signs was a universal symbol of that. And Junaid Jamshid was a cultural icon. Shoaib Mansoor, the director of the movie, was actually one of the figures who propelled Vital Signs to fame in the 1980s. He was the director for their music videos, which started showing on state television, and also the writer for some of their biggest hits. After 2001, Junaid Jamshid took a serious 180-degree turn from a very westernized popular musician who wore jeans and T-shirts to a very religious figure in Pakistan. And Junaid Jamshid became one of the most vocal people arguing against the allowance of music in Islam and in Pakistan.
In addition to Jamshid, I understand several star cricket players have been outspoken against the evils of music. Has the fight over music become a symbolic battleground in Pakistan?
That's very true. Music, it defines territory like, I mean, women's rights have in this country for a while. And now music are also territory where Islam and different versions and visions of Islam are battling on. Musicians routinely complain and go to the media about threats they are receiving from Islamist groups. So the arts are a hot issue in the country right now. And it's one where moderate voices of Islam can make a good case for. And this movie does try to make a case, not only with just pure human reasoning, but also tries to make a case in an Islamic framework for the allowance of music and the allowance of entertainment and the arts.
You said that this movie had a different kind of audience. It was more middle and upper class Pakistanis who were going to see it. I just wonder, is it making its way to areas controlled by the Islamic parties?
The movie is not being shown in the Northwest Frontier or Balochistan provinces bordering Afghanistan and Iran, and it most likely will not anytime soon. The Balochis and the Pashtuns, who make up the largest section of the population in the western provinces, are depicted not in the best light. They're shown as militant, violent, and chauvinist religious fanatics.
Is this essentially propaganda for the Musharraf government?
this movie does paint a scenario in Pakistan where everything can be explained through an ideological battle between radical militant Islam and what can be viewed as an enlightened moderate version of Islam. It avoids politics, and it avoids economic discrepancies in this country, and it avoids the judiciary or the military. This is a view that suits the military government quite well, because this is an aversion of the story that it can take a moral high stand on.
Do you think the film has a message to international audiences who might see it from outside of Pakistan?
Well, the other half of the story about the brother who leaves Pakistan and goes out to study music in Chicago, this character finds himself in the United States when the Twin Towers were attacked in New York City. He's proceeded to get picked up by the authorities and tortured in a jail cell. So part of the message of the movie is also how Pakistanis and Muslims in the Western countries who have made lives for themselves and sometimes making successful lives for themselves have also been a casualty of religious extremism and militancy at home. And that level, it is really dealing with the expatriate population of Pakistan that has suffered in the Western world.
Shahan, thank you very much.
You're welcome. It was great talking to you.
Shahan Mufti is a reporter in Islamabad, Pakistan, for the Christian Science Monitor.
Coming up, Russian hackers offer customer service with their criminal software.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support from the media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A few months ago, Universal Music Group, the biggest of the four record labels, filed suit in federal court against California resident Troy Augusto. Augusto makes a living buying collectible CDs, mostly rare promotional copies, and then reselling them on eBay. Universal, however, has argued that it still owns those CDs, and Augusto isn't authorized to sell them. Fred Von Lohman is a senior attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation and is defending Augusto. He says the lawsuit strikes at the very heart of what's called the first sale doctrine, which was established a century ago by the Supreme Court in Bob's Merrill Company versus Strauss.
It involved a novel entitled The Castaways. This is back in 1908 in New York City. Macy's was selling the novel for 89 cents a copy. And this upset the publisher, who wanted a minimum price of $1 a copy in all of their retail channels. And there was a lawsuit. And Macy's said, hey, we bought the book from a wholesaler fair and square, and if we want to discount it, that's our business, and the copyright owner doesn't have control of that. And the Supreme Court ultimately agreed and said a copyright owner cannot control further sales or lending or other disposition of a novel or, in today's parlance, a compact disc or any other copyrighted work once ownership has passed out of the copyright owner's hands into the hands of someone who purchased or otherwise lawfully acquired it.
Now, I gather that the name first sale doctrine can be itself misleading, because the law applies not only to copyright items that are sold, but to those that are given away.
That's right. In 1984, there's a case involving a former Walt Disney employee who had worked for the company for many years and, while working for the company, was given a number of animation cells for famous Disney cartoons. And after he retired, and I think after he passed away, he ultimately decided to sell those cells. And Disney tried to stop him, claiming that, hey, those were gifts. Disney continues to own them. The first sale doctrine does not apply. And the court rejected that and said, no, the first sale doctrine, despite its somewhat misleading name, applies whether the copyright owner sold it or whether they gave it away. And of course, in the case of promotional CDs, that's exactly what the record labels, including Universal, are up to. They give away thousands of copies of these discs to tastemakers, magazines, radio stations, and the like.
And in fact, I should, as a matter of full disclosure, point out that On the Media gets quite a number of these things. which we, for the most part, take to a used bookstore and sell so we can give going-away parties to departing staffers.
Don't tell Universal.
So who knows if we're next in the litigation machine. But tell me exactly what Troy Augusto was doing that so got under the skin of the Universal Music Group.
Troy Augusto makes his living basically doing the age-old thing. He buys low and he sells high. He goes to Los Angeles area record stores. He finds CDs that he recognizes as being collectible, valuable to a certain set of fans, picks those up and resells them on eBay for, he hopes, a profit. And it appears that major record labels, not just Universal, they object to certain promotional CDs being resold. For those auctions on eBay, the labels will send notices to eBay to try to stop those auctions. And Mr. Augusto has, to his credit, stood up for his rights and said, hey, I'm entitled to sell these. I own them. I bought them fair and square. You guys gave them away. The first sale doctrine ought to apply.
If he were not to just resell the physical CD, but to take it home to his computer, copy it, and then sell the digital file electronically, not just to one person, but to tens of people or hundreds or thousands, would you be in this case in his support?
I don't think so. That would be a very different circumstance. And the first sale doctrine does not apply to additional copies that you make. Very simply put, if you buy a CD, you should be allowed to resell that CD or to give that CD away. Under both copyright law and, I think, common sense, that's a very different proposition than making additional copies of your own. And the law does recognize that as an important difference.
Let's just say that Universal Music Group should prevail in this case and the first sale precedent should be overturned. I'm assuming that the implications are far greater than Troy Augusto's ability to cobble out a living.
That's exactly right. If Universal here is able to trump the first sale doctrine by putting a little label on a product that says, for promotional use only, not for resale, then I think you're going to see a lot of copyright owners try to do the same kind of thing. You're going to see labels that say, this book, not for use in libraries, for personal reading only. You're going to see labels on DVDs that say, this DVD, not for video rental, for home use only. The American Association of Publishers, I think, really puts the point on this. They represent book publishers in the United States, and they have always had an uneasy relationship with libraries because they feel that librarians buy books and then they give them out, loan them for free. That has led Pat Schroeder, the head of the association, to say that they have, quote, serious issues with libraries, unquote. And one of their spokespeople back in 2001 compared some in the library community to Ruby Ridge and Waco-style terrorists. So first sale is incredibly important if you believe in things like libraries and used bookstores.
All right, Fred. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Fred von Lohmann is the senior intellectual property attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
The culture of computer hackers has always been one of the self-styled renegade, but now a group of Russians who call themselves the Dream Coders Team have turned hacking into a pretty traditional business venture, almost. They sell their user-friendly hacking software called MPAC with customer service plans that include free upgrades for a year. Robert Lemos is a technology reporter and editor-at-large for Security Focus, an online news site owned by the antivirus company Symantec. Robert, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me about MPAC.
MPAC is what's known as an infection toolkit. It's basically a collection of programs that makes it easier for a hacker to take over a victim's computer. You infect them with your software, either through email or through compromised websites. One of the most common uses is to steal their information, steal their bank account information. Other uses being to use their computer for an attack or to use their computer to send spam.
I've read elsewhere that this is sort of the Rolls Royce of hacking programs. It's really top of the line. What makes it so good?
I think at this point, the better analogy is it's more kind of the assembly line Ford. They're now getting to the point where they're looking for volume and sales. They have a fairly limited customer base from what I gathered. I mean, we're talking probably dozens, maybe hundreds of people.
These kinds of programs are traditionally available for free, aren't they, because of the renegade culture that I referred to? Why would people pay money for MPAC, and how much do they pay?
It goes anywhere from $700 to $1,000 for this, the legitimate, I guess you can call it the legitimate version. There are other versions out there, and after I did the article, a lot more versions of MPAC came out that were basically people finding the code online, making a copy of it, and then turning around and trying to sell it for a discount, which is why I think that they're focusing on the support aspect of this.
The support aspect meaning upgrades. There isn't actually a helpline you can call. Hey, I'm having trouble hacking into the Bank of India. Can you give me some online help? You know, somebody named Peter from Bangalore?
Right. What they're doing is they're basically providing free upgrades for a year. They're also, every time a new vulnerability comes out in popular software, they'll create an exploit, this code to actually use that vulnerability to take over someone's system, and they'll then ship that with a new version of the software. But there's also some neat, I guess you'd call them neat business features. They'll, for instance, give you statistics on how successful your infections have been.
So you actually interviewed, or at least you think you interviewed, the MPAC developers. Explain how you found them.
I searched using Google to find the advertisements online. In those advertisements, there was an IM nickname. And so I sent a note to the person at that number. And I think it was a day later, basically, I got a response back from someone who said, hey, you contacted us. We'd like to talk to you.
Do they say they're making money?
Not much. It's their customers that seem to be making a lot more money. They had sent me a photo that seemed a little bit gratuitous, but it was basically of a desk with a computer on it covered with money. And they said it was from one of their customers, and it represented about $50,000 that he had made.
So do you think that, you know, with hacking software that comes with a customer service package, we're really coming to the end of hacker culture as the underground anti-corporate renegade?
Well, I think you're always going to have that. I mean, the hackers will lament that suddenly hacking became commercialized. I think that there will always be hackers in the old school sense of it, which is just people with a lot of intellectual curiosity and willing to take things apart. But more and more, I think we'll see those people lured by the criminal element.
Don't these guys make you mad?
You know, me personally, I've never, as far as I know, been a victim yet. For me, it's not yet become personal. And I'm sure for a lot of people who it has become personal, this does make them very mad.
Does it have to happen to you personally before you feel personally violated?
You know, for anything on the internet, in some ways it does. I mean, the internet's all about being connected to everybody, but not feeling like everybody else, I guess. Basically, until it happens to you, most people don't even think about this.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for your time.
Robert Lemos is a freelance reporter and editor for Security Focus, a news website owned by the antivirus company Symantec. Photography to the VCR to streaming video, advances in communications technology have often been driven by the popularity of porn. Look no further than the internet, where the virtual red light district shines so bright that nearly anyone online is left a little pink. But Regina Lin, a sex and technology correspondent for Wired.com, argued recently that, as a whole, the adult content industry may actually be losing its techno mojo, falling behind in the current online environment known as Web 2.0, which enables us not merely to consume content, but to participate in shaping it and form communities around it.
Anything from rating the content, allowing users to take existing content and mash it up and create new movies and things. Contests, you know, everybody make a minute and a half porn movie out of all of this material. they add a bit of play and a bit of game and just a lot of interaction into it. I mean, it's basically taking porn and making it relationships. For the main industry, it's really hard to incorporate that because you've got to think a whole new way. You have to think of your users with respect and as sort of partners in the whole experience versus sheep that you're fleecing.
But if, as you say, the engine driving the internet these days is focused more on community or participation with content rather than just on simply providing content, why do you think the porn industry is falling behind? Is it just because it's all about money for them?
It is more complicated than that. There's just some catch-up to do. I think porn is very cheap to make. You can get some people together and make it in a day for a few thousand dollars. When you start having community involvement, you need to have people on the site monitoring things, maybe moderating things. You need to have your talent on the site doing chats and interacting with users and things like that. So there's more organization that a lot of porn companies aren't set up to do because they just make videos, churn them out, burn them to DVDs, or post them on the web, and out they go.
So there's more expense, there's more organization. But aren't there also some legal barriers to increased participation with porn sites?
Yes, and I think that's probably the biggest hurdle, the detailed records that a porn producer needs to keep that prove that all of the talent is 18 or older at the time of filming and their home addresses and all these different pieces of information that get really hard to wrangle if you have a site where users can come in and post their own videos of themselves. And so I don't think we know quite yet how the adult industry is going to handle that.
But you say that there are some enterprising sites that seem to have gotten around some of these restrictions.
There are some. I don't know if they've gotten around them or just haven't been caught yet. But there are ways to do it. For one thing, you can have all your user-submitted content be text and not pictures, or pictures that can be maybe R or NC-17 rated but not hardcore sex. And then you can also have all of your porn video and pictures out there for the users to mix and match and make new movies out of that content. So you can still offer several ways to participate. And then there are some sites where people do post, you know, whatever they want of themselves. And if the users are providing the content, it might just come down that the users are the ones responsible. But I don't think it's been decided yet. I think that's a huge gray area right now.
I was just wondering if there's something about the culture of porn that sort of works against community building. I mean, I guess we always think of consumers of adult content as preferring anonymity and solitude.
You can have community and a certain level of anonymity because you're not out there with your social security number on the site. You're out there with your handle and your online self. I said in a conference recently that if you want to build community in adult spaces, look to the women. The independent websites that women put together where they are the performers and they do the whole thing on their own as their maybe their home-based business are all based on community and have been for more than 10 years. Talking to their fans, talking to the visitors, building relationships with the fans who then bring in other people and who then stick around. I know one webcam performer who has had the same members for 7 or 8 years.
Do porn sites really suffer or pay a penalty for being slow to adapt to this new evolving online world?
I think they will. If you think of today's 12 to 17-year-olds who have not yet looked at porn, when they turn 18 and they look at their very first adult content, this is a generation who is so used to having complete participation and control in their media that if the adult industry continues to just sort of put out content that's intended to be watched passively, they're going to lose this entire generation.
And if the porn industry no longer has anything special to teach us about the future of communications technology, if it's hit the wall as a tech innovator, should we even care how it's doing?
I don't think it's hit the wall as a tech innovator, though. We're seeing other kinds of innovations coming out of it, like attaching hardware so that you're watching the video and what's happening in the video is powering the hardware that is touching your body and giving you pleasure. So I think they are definitely going to continue pushing technological innovation. Our need for erotic content and our sex drives are going to continue. Whether an industry continues to make billions of dollars on it versus all of us making our own and sharing it that's, I think, what we're going to see in the next 10 years. It's going to go one way or the other.
Well, maybe we'll talk again after porn-driven technology enables the blind to see.
Well, doesn't porn make you go blind?
Regina, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Regina Lynn writes the Sex Drive column for Wired.com.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Madeline Ellish and Andrea Ambro. This week, I'm sorry to say, for the last time, our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.